is generally the first word out of your mouth. What starts as a doomed discussion ends up with a healthy resolution. It can take your breath away. More important, not only are dialogue skills easy to spot, but they're also fairly easy to learn. That's where we're going next. We've isolated and captured the skills of the dialogue gifted through 25 years of nonstop wow research. First, we followed around Kevin and others like him. Then, when conversations turned crucial, we took detailed notes. Afterwards, we compared our observations, tested our hypotheses, and honed our models until we found the skills that consistently explain the success of brilliant communicators. Finally, we combined our philosophies, theories, models, and skills into a package of learnable tools, tools for talking when stakes are high. We then taught these skills and watched as key performance indicators and relationships improved. Now we're ready to share what we've learned. Stay with us as we explore how to transform crucial conversations from frightening events into interactions that yield success and results. It's the most important set of skills you'll ever master. My Crucial Conversation, Bobby R. My crucial conversation began on the night before my first deployment to Iraq in 2004. There was a lot of tension between members of my family caused by past events and conflicting perspectives. The stress of my leaving to combat only increased the tension. On that night, one well-intended but deeply loaded question from my father sent me through the roof. The way I reacted over the next couple of hours started a downward spiral that affected my entire family. Siblings, cousins, aunts, uncles, parents, children, and grandparents all took sides. My family ties continued to unravel as I led a platoon of soldiers through the streets of Baghdad. My wife was home with our one-year-old and pregnant with our second. During my tour, additional family encounters only worsened the situation, and when I came home after 14 months in combat, I came home to a family that was completely broken at every existing generation. The silence between me and my father continued for 5 years. Crucial conversations saved my relationship with my parents. A neighbor who is a crucial conversations trainer invited me to his class before my third tour in Iraq. A couple of weeks before I deployed, I reached out to my father to let him know about the two children he had never seen and that I was leaving for combat. I told him I couldn't make the same mistake I had made 5 years earlier, and we agreed to meet. On a beautiful sunset balcony in Houston, my dad and I spent 3 tense hours dealing with a lot of pain and built-up resentment. I kept in mind what I had been taught, and rather than compromising candor, tried my best to create the conditions where we could be both honest and respectful. It was incredibly difficult. Sometimes the honesty threatened to put us right back in the angry state that got us there. But I kept focusing on what I really wanted, a relationship with my family. At the end of the conversation, we met my mom for dinner. She had been the most hurt by my anger in the past and was skeptical that I was still the argumentative, sarcastic, spiteful, and arrogant child of my youth. She gave me a chance based on my father's assessment of my respect, remorse, and clear demonstration of mutual purpose. While we haven't dealt with everything, I am now in a loving relationship with my wife, 4 children, and parents. We have agreed to never bury our concerns in silence again. I attribute the relationship I have today to the success of that one crucial conversation on the balcony. Had I not practiced what I had learned, my relationship with my father would have died from anger and indifference. That conversation happened because of a friend who introduced me to crucial conversations. Bobby R. Here's where we're going. Throughout the remainder of the book, we'll explore the tools people use to help create the conditions of dialogue. The focus is on how we think about problem situations and what we do to prepare for them. As we work on ourselves, watch for problems, examine our own thought processes, discover our own styles, and then catch problems before they get out of hand, everyone benefits. As you read on, you will learn how to create conditions in yourself and others that make dialogue the path of least resistance. Next, we'll examine the tools for talking, listening, and acting together. This is what most people have in mind when they think of crucial conversations. How do I express delicate feedback? How do I speak persuasively, not abrasively? And how about listening? Or better still, what can we do to get people to talk when they seem nervous? And how do we move from thought to action? As you read on, you will learn the key skills of talking, listening, and acting together. Finally, we'll tie all of the theories and skills together by providing both a model and an extended example. Then, to see if you can really do what it takes, we provide 17 situations that would give most of us fits, even people who are gifted at dialogue. As you read on, you will master the tools for talking when stakes are high. Chapter 3. Start with heart. How to stay focused on what you really want. Speak when you are angry, and you will make the best speech you will ever regret. Ambrose Bierce. It's time to turn to the how of dialogue. How do you encourage the flow of meaning in the face of differing opinions and strong emotions? Given the average person's track record, it can't be all that easy. In fact, given that most people's style is based on long-standing habits, it'll probably require a lot of effort. The truth is, people can change. In fact, we've trained these skills to millions around the world and have seen dramatic improvements in results and relationships, but it requires work. You can't simply drink a magic potion and walk away changed. Instead, you'll need to take a long, hard look at yourself. In fact, this is the first principle of dialogue. Start with heart. That is, your own heart. If you can't get yourself right, you'll have a hard time getting dialogue right. When conversations become crucial, you'll resort to the forms of communication that you've grown up with. Debate, silent treatment, manipulation, and so on. Work on me first, us second. Let's start with a true story. Two young sisters and their father scurry into their hotel room after spending a hot afternoon at Disneyland. Given the repressive heat, the girls have consumed enough soda pop to fill a small barrel. As the two bursting kids enter their room, they have but one thought: to head for the head. Since the bathroom is a one-holer, it isn't long until a fight breaks out. Both of the desperate children start arguing, pushing, and name-calling as they dance around the tiny bathroom. Eventually, one calls out to her father for help. "Dad, I got here first." "I know, but I need to go worse." "How do you know? You're not in my body. I didn't even go before we left this morning. You're so selfish." Dad proposes a plan. "Girls, I'm not going to solve this for you. You can stay in the bathroom and figure out who goes first and who goes second. There's only one rule: no hitting." As the two antsy kids begin their crucial conversation, Dad checks his watch. He wonders how long it'll take. As the minutes slowly tick away, he hears nothing more than an occasional outburst of sarcasm. Finally, after 25 long minutes, the toilet flushes. One girl comes out. A minute later, another flush, and out walks her sister. With both girls in the room, Dad asks, "Do you know how many times both of you could have gone to the bathroom in the time it took you to work that out?" The idea had not occurred to the little scamps. Dad then probed further. "Why did it take so long for two of you to use the restroom?"
"Because she's always so selfish. Listen to her. She's calling me names when she could have just waited. She always has to have her way."
Both girls claimed what they wanted most was to go to the bathroom. Then they behaved in ways that ensured the bathroom was little more than a distant dream. And that's the first problem we face in our crucial conversations. Our problem is not that our behavior degenerates. It's that our motives do, a fact that we usually miss. So the first step to achieving the results we really want is to fix the problem of believing that others are the source of all that ails us. It's our dogmatic conviction that, quote, "if we could just fix those losers, all would go better," close quote, that keeps us from taking action that could lead to dialogue and progress. Which is why it's no surprise that those who are best at dialogue tend to turn this logic around. They believe the best way to work on us is to start with me. Don't look at me. Although it's true that there are times when we are merely bystanders in life's never-ending stream of head-on collisions, rarely are we completely innocent. More often than not, we do something that contributes to the problems we're experiencing. People who are best at dialogue understand this simple fact and turn it into the principle, work on me first, us second. They realize not only that they are likely to benefit by improving their own approach, but also that they're the only person they can work on. As much as others may need to change, or we may want them to change, the only person we can continually inspire, prod, and shape with any degree of success is the person in the mirror. There's a certain irony embedded in this fact. People who believe they need to start with themselves do just that. As they work on themselves, they also become the most skilled at dialogue. So here's the irony. It's the most talented, not the least talented, who are continually trying to improve their dialogue skills. As is often the case, the rich get richer. Start with heart. Okay, let's assume we need to work on our own personal dialogue skills. Instead of buying this book and then handing it to a loved one or coworker and saying, "You'll love this, especially the parts that I've underlined for you," we'll try to figure out how we ourselves can benefit. But how? Where do we start? How can we stay clear of unhealthy games? Although it's difficult to describe the specific order of events in an interaction as fluid as a crucial conversation, we do know one thing for certain. Skilled people start with heart. That is, they begin high-risk discussions with the right motives, and they stay focused no matter what happens. They maintain this focus in two ways. First, they're steely-eyed smart when it comes to knowing what they want. Despite constant invitations to slip away from their goals, they stick with them. Second, skilled people don't make fool's choices, either-or choices. Unlike others who justify their unhealthy behavior by explaining that they had no choice but to fight or take flight, the dialogue smart believe that dialogue, no matter the circumstances, is always an option. Let's look at each of these important heart-based assumptions in turn. A moment of truth. To see how the desires of our hearts can affect our ability to stay in dialogue, let's take a look at a real-life example. Greta, the CEO of a mid-sized corporation, is 2 hours into a rather tense meeting with her top leaders. For the past 6 months, she has been on a personal campaign to reduce costs. Little has been accomplished to date, so Greta calls the meeting. Surely people will tell her why they haven't started cutting costs. After all, she has taken great pains to foster candor. Greta has just opened the meeting to questions when a manager haltingly rises to his feet, fidgets, stares at the floor, and then nervously asks if he can ask a very tough question. The way the fellow emphasizes the word "very" makes it sound as if he's about to accuse Greta of kidnapping the Lindbergh baby. The frightened manager continues, "Greta, you've been at us for 6 months to find ways to cut costs. I'd be lying if I said that we've given you much more than a lukewarm response. If you don't mind, I'd like to tell you about one thing that's making it tough for us to push for cost cuts." "Great. Fire away," Greta says as she smiles in response. "While you've been asking us to use both sides of our paper and forego improvements, you're having a second office built." Greta freezes and turns bright red. Everyone looks to see what will happen next. The manager plunges on ahead. "The rumor is that the furniture alone will cost $150,000. Is that right?" So there we have it. The conversation has just turned crucial. Someone has just poured a rather ugly tidbit into the pool of meaning. Will Greta continue to encourage honest feedback, or will she shut the fellow down? We call this a crucial conversation because how Greta acts during the next few moments will not only set people's attitudes towards the proposed cost-cutting initiative, but will also have a huge impact on what the other leaders think about her. Does she walk the talk of openness and honesty? Or is she a raging hypocrite like so many of the senior executives who came before her? What is she acting like she wants? As we watch Greta, something quite subtle
and yet very important, takes place. It is lost on most of the people in the room, but with our front row seat, it is practically palpable. Greta's jaw tightens. She leans forward and grips the left side of the rostrum hard enough that her knuckles turn white. She lifts her right hand, with the finger pointing at the questioner like a loaded weapon. She hasn't said anything yet, but it is clear where Greta is heading. Her motive has clearly changed from making the right choice to something far less noble. Like most of us in similar circumstances, Greta is no longer focused on cost-cutting. Her attention is now turned to staff-cutting, beginning with one particular staff member. When under attack, our heart can take a similarly sudden and unconscious turn. When faced with pressure and strong opinions, we often stop worrying about the goal of adding to the pool of meaning and start looking for ways to win, punish, or keep the peace. Winning. This particular dialogue killer sits at the top of many of our lists. Heaven only knows that we come by this deadly passion naturally enough. Half of the TV programs we watch make heroes out of people who win at sports or game shows. 10 minutes into kindergarten, we learn that if we want to get the teacher's attention, we have to spout the right answer. That means we have to beat our fellow students at the same game. This desire to win is built into our very fiber before we're old enough to know what's going on. Unfortunately, as we grow older, most of us don't realize that this desire to win is continually driving us away from healthy dialogue. We start out with the goal of resolving a problem, but as soon as someone raises the red flag of inaccuracy or challenges our correctness, we switch purposes in a heartbeat. First, we correct the facts. We quibble over details and point out flaws in the other person's arguments. You're wrong. We're not spending anywhere near $150,000 on the furniture. It's the redesign of the office that's costing so much, not the furniture. Of course, as others push back, trying to prove their points, it's not long until we change our goal from correcting mistakes to winning. If you doubt this simple allegation, think of the two antsy young girls as they stared each other down in the cramped bathroom. Their original goal was simple enough. Relief. But soon, caught up in their own painful game, the two set their jaws and committed to doing whatever it took to win, even if it brought them a fair amount of personal discomfort. Punishing. Sometimes, as our anger increases, we move from wanting to win the point to wanting to harm the other person. Just ask Greta. To heck with honest communication, she thinks to herself. I'll teach the moron not to attack me in public. Eventually, as emotions reach their peak, our goal becomes completely perverted. We move so far away from adding meaning to the pool that now all we want is to see others suffer. I can't believe that you're accusing me of squandering good money on a perfectly fine office. Now, if nobody else has any intelligent questions, let's move on. Everyone immediately clams up and looks at the floor. The silence is deafening. Keeping the peace. Of course, we don't always fix mistakes, aggressively discredit others, or heartlessly try to make them suffer. Sometimes we choose personal safety over dialogue. Rather than add to the pool of meaning and possibly make waves along the way, we go to silence. We're so uncomfortable with the immediate conflict that we accept the certainty of bad results to avoid the possibility of uncomfortable conversation. We choose, at least in our minds, peace over conflict. Had this happened in Greta's case, nobody would have raised concerns over the new office. Greta never would have learned the real issue, and people would have continued to drag their feet. To watch a painfully familiar example of an awkward performance review, go to crucialconversations.com/exclusive. First, focus on what you really want. In reality, Greta didn't give in to her raging desire to defend herself. Almost as soon as her finger rose, like a loaded pistol, it dropped back to her side. Her face relaxed. At first she looked surprised, embarrassed, and maybe even a little upset. But then she took a deep breath and said, "You know what? We need to talk about this." I'm glad you asked the question. Thank you for taking that risk. I appreciate the trust it shows in me. Wow. We were struck. In a matter of seconds, she had transformed from a dangerous weapon into a curious partner. And then Greta talked turkey. She acknowledged the apparent hypocrisy in talking cost-cutting while spending on a new office. She admitted that she did not know what the project would cost and asked someone to leave the meeting to check the numbers. She explained that building the office was a response to marketing's advice to boost the company's image and improve client confidence. And while Greta would use the office, it would be primarily a hosting location for marketing. But, she added, I have not managed this project as tightly as I'm asking you to manage yours, and that's hypocritical. When she saw the figures for the office, Greta was stunned and admitted that she should have checked the costs before assigning a work order. A wonderfully candid exchange followed, wherein various participants in the meeting expressed their views about the propriety of the project. In the end, they agreed to move ahead, but cut the costs by half or cancel the project entirely. While others were engaged in this crucial conversation, those of us studying the interaction were thinking of something entirely different. We were wondering what had happened to Greta. How, we puzzled, did she remain so composed while under fire? Specifically, how did she move so quickly from wanting to get even with, or possibly even humiliate the questioner, to sincerely soliciting feedback? Later that day, we asked Greta about that transformation. We wanted to know exactly what had been going on in her head. What had helped her to move from embarrassment and anger to gratitude? It was easy, Greta explained. At first I did feel attacked, and I wanted to strike back. To be honest, I wanted to put that guy in his place. He was accusing me in public, and he was wrong. And then it struck me, she continued. Despite the fact that I had 400 eyeballs pinned to me, a rather important question hit me like a ton of bricks. What do I really want here? Asking this question had a powerful effect on Greta's thinking. As she focused on this far more important question, she quickly realized that her goal was to encourage these 200 managers to embrace the cost reduction efforts and to thereby influence thousands of others to do the same. As Greta contemplated this goal, she realized that the biggest barrier she faced was the widespread belief that she was a hypocrite. On the one hand, she was calling for others to sacrifice. On the other, she appeared to be spending discretionary funds for her own comfort. It was at that moment that she was no longer ashamed or angry, but grateful. Interestingly, by transforming her motives, Greta simultaneously transformed the way she saw the man who asked the question. Whereas seconds earlier, he looked like an enemy. When her motives changed, the fellow now looked like an ally. In fact, this man had just handed her the best chance she could get to influence the audience by letting her publicly address a primary source of resistance to the cost-cutting effort. And so, Greta moved to dialogue. Greta taught us that a small mental intervention, the simple act of asking a potent question, can have a powerful effect on redirecting our hearts. Refocus your brain. Now, let's move to a situation you might face. You're speaking with someone who completely disagrees with you on a hot issue. How does all of this goal stuff apply? As you begin the discussion, start by examining your motives. Going in, ask yourself what you really want. Also, as the conversation unfolds and you find yourself starting to, say, defer to the boss or give your spouse the cold shoulder, pay attention to what's happening to your objectives. Are you starting to change your goal to save face, avoid embarrassment, win, be right, or punish others? Here's the tricky part. Our motives usually change without any conscious thought on our part. When adrenaline does our thinking for us, our motives flow with the chemical tide. In order to move back to motives that allow for dialogue, you must step away from the interaction and look at yourself, much like an outsider. Ask yourself, what am I doing? And if I had to guess, what does it tell me about my underlying motive?
As you make an honest effort to discover your motive, you might conclude, let's see, I'm pushing hard, making the argument stronger than I actually believe, and doing anything to win. I've shifted from trying to select a vacation location to trying to win an argument. Once you call into question the shifting desires of your heart, you can make conscious choices to change them. What I really want is to genuinely try to select a vacation spot we can all enjoy rather than try to win people over to my ideas. Put succinctly, when you name the game, you can stop playing it. But how? How do you recognize what has happened to you, stop playing games, and then influence your own motives? Do what Greta did. Stop and ask yourself some questions that return you to dialogue. You can ask these questions either when you find yourself slipping out of dialogue or as reminders when you prepare to step up to a crucial conversation. Here are some great ones. What do I really want for myself? What do I really want for others? What do I really want for the relationship? Once you've asked yourself what you want, add one more equally telling question. How would I behave if I really wanted these results? Find your bearings. There are two good reasons for asking these questions. First, the answer to what we really want helps us to locate our own North Star. Despite the fact that we're being tempted to take the wrong path by, one, people who are trying to pick a fight, two, thousands of years of genetic hardwiring that brings our emotions to a quick boil, and three, our deeply ingrained habit of trying to win, our North Star returns us to our original purpose. What do I really want? Oh, yeah. I guess it's not to make the other person squirm or to preen in front of a crowd. I want people to freely and openly talk about what it'll take to cut costs. Take charge of your body. The second reason for asking what we really want is no less important. When we ask ourselves what we really want, we affect our entire physiology. As we introduce complex and abstract questions to our mind, the problem-solving part of our brain recognizes that we are now dealing with intricate social issues and not physical threats. When we present our brain with a demanding question, our body sends precious blood to the parts of our brain that help us think and away from the parts of our body that help us take flight or begin a fight. Asking questions about what we really want serves two important purposes. First, it reminds us of our goal. Second, it juices up our brain in a way that helps us keep focused. Second, refuse the fool's choice. Now, let's add one more tool that helps us focus on what we really want. We'll start with a story. The faculty of Beaumont High School is hashing out possible curriculum changes in an after-school meeting that's been going on for hours. It's finally the science department's turn to present. Royce, a chemistry teacher who's been at Beaumont for 33 years, considers himself the elder statesman of the school. He's much fonder of war stories than he is of neutrons and electrons, but the administration kind of turns a blind eye because the guy's a fixture. At the principal's cue, Royce clears his throat and begins to yammer on incoherently about the similarities between curriculum development and battle preparations. His antics are so embarrassing that the audience quietly heaves their shoulders as they futilely try to stifle their laughter. Next, it's Brent's, the new guy's turn. A couple of weeks ago, the principal asked him to outline the science department's proposed curriculum changes. Brent met with his colleagues, even Royce, gathered suggestions, and came ready to present. As Brent begins, Royce starts demonstrating bayonet offensives with a yardstick, and Brent snaps. Slamming his fist on the table, he shouts, "Am I the only one who wonders why we even allow this fossil to talk? Did he miss a pill or something?" A room full of stunned faces turns toward Brent. Realizing that his colleagues must think he's possessed, Brent utters those words we've all come to hate. "Hey, don't look at me like that. I'm the only one around who has the guts to speak the truth." What a tactic. Brent slams Royce in public, and then instead of apologizing, or maybe simply fading into the shadows, he argues that what he just did was somehow noble. As we saw in the previous chapter with Kevin's colleagues, under the influence of adrenaline, we start to see our options as unnecessarily limited. We assume we have to choose between getting results and keeping a relationship. In our dumbed-down condition, we don't even consider the option of achieving both. That's why those who are skilled at crucial conversations present their brain with a more complex question. They routinely ask, "What do I want for myself, the other person, and the relationship?" As you practice presenting this question to yourself at emotional times, you'll discover that at first you resist it. When our brain isn't functioning well, we resist complexity. We adore the ease of simply choosing between attacking or hiding, and the fact that we think it makes us look good. "I'm sorry, but I just had to destroy the guy's self-image if I was going to keep my integrity. It wasn't pretty, but it was the right thing to do." Fortunately, when you refuse the fool's choice, when you require your brain to solve the more complex problem, more often than not, it does just that. You'll find there is a way to share your concerns, listen sincerely to those of others, and build the relationship all at the same time. And the results can be life-changing. Search for the elusive and. The best at dialogue refuse fools' choices by setting up new choices. They present themselves with tougher questions, questions that turn the either-or choice into a search for the all-important and ever-elusive and. It is an endangered species, you know. Here's how this works. First, clarify what you really want. You've got a head start if you've already started with heart. If you know what you want for yourself, for others, and for the relationship, then you're in position to break out of the fool's choice. "What I want is for my husband to be more reliable. I'm tired of being let down by him when he makes commitments that I depend on." Second, clarify what you really don't want. This is the key to framing the and question. Think of what you are afraid will happen to you if you back away from your current strategy of trying to win or stay safe. What bad thing will happen if you stop pushing so hard, or if you don't try to escape? What horrible outcome makes game playing an attractive and sensible option? "What I don't want is to have a useless and heated conversation that creates bad feelings and doesn't lead to change." Third, present your brain with a more complex problem. Finally, combine the two into an and question that forces you to search for more creative and productive options than silence and violence. How can I have a candid conversation with my husband about being more dependable and avoid creating bad feelings or wasting our time? It's interesting to watch what happens when people are presented with and questions after being stuck with fool's choices. Their faces become reflective, their eyes open wider, and they begin to think. With surprising regularity, when people are asked, "Is it possible that there's a way to accomplish both?" they acknowledge that there very well may be. Is there a way to tell your peer your real concerns and not insult or offend him? Is there a way to talk to your neighbors about their annoying behavior and not come across as self-righteous or demanding? Is there a way to talk with your loved one about how you're spending money and not get into an argument? Is this really possible? Some people believe that this whole line of thinking is comically unrealistic. From their point of view, fool's choices aren't false dichotomies. They're merely a reflection of an unfortunate reality. You can't say something to the boss about our upcoming move. It'll cost your job. To these people we say, "Remember Kevin?" He, and almost every other opinion leader we've ever studied, has what it takes to speak up and maintain respect. Maybe you don't know what Kevin did or what you need to do, but don't deny the existence of Kevin or people like him. There is a third set of options out there that allows you to add meaning to the pool and build on the relationship. When we, the authors, are in the middle of an on-site workshop and we suggest there are alternatives to fool's choices, someone invariably says,
Maybe you can speak honestly and still be heard in other organizations, but if you try it here, you'll be eaten alive. Or the flip side. You've got to know when to fold if you want to survive for another day. Then in a hail of, I'll say, and hear, hear, many nod in agreement. At first we thought that maybe there were places where dialogue couldn't survive. But then we learned to ask, are you saying there isn't anyone you know who is able to hold a high-risk conversation in a way that solves problems and builds relationships? There usually is. Summary. Start with heart. Here's how people who are skilled at dialogue stay focused on their goals, particularly when the going gets tough. First, focus on me first, us second. Remember that the only person you can directly control is yourself. Second, focus on what you really want. When you find yourself moving towards silence or violence, stop and pay attention to your motives. Ask yourself, what does my behavior tell me about what my motives are? Then, clarify what you really want. Ask yourself, what do I want for myself, for others, for the relationship? And finally, ask, how would I behave if this were what I really wanted? Third, refuse the fool's choice. As you consider what you want, notice when you start talking yourself into a fool's choice. Watch to see if you're telling yourself that you must choose between peace and honesty, between winning and losing, and so on. Break free of these fool's choices by searching for the and. Clarify what you don't want, add it to what you do want, and ask your brain to start searching for healthy options to bring you to dialogue. Chapter 4. Learn to look. How to notice when safety is at risk. I have known 1,000 scamps, but I never met one who considered himself so. Self-knowledge isn't so common. Ouida. Let's start this chapter by visiting a failed, crucial conversation. You just ended a heated debate with a group of people you supervise. What started out as a harmless discussion about your new product timelines ended up as a nasty argument. After an hour of carping and complaining, you finally went to your separate corners. You're now walking down the hall wondering what happened. In a matter of minutes, an innocent discussion had transformed into a crucial conversation, and then into a failed conversation, and you can't recall why. You do remember a tense moment when you started pushing your point of view a bit too hard. Okay, maybe way too hard. And 8 people stared at you as if you had just bitten the head off a chicken. But then the meeting ended. What you don't realize is that 2 of your friends are walking down the hallway in the opposite direction, conducting a play-by-play of the meeting. They do know what took place. It happened again. The boss started pushing so hard for personal agenda items that we all began to act defensively. Did you notice how at one point all of our jaws dropped simultaneously? Of course, I was just as bad as the boss. I spoke in absolutes, only pointed out facts that supported my view, and then ended with a list of outlandish claims. I got hooked like a marlin. Later that day, as you talked to your friends about the meeting, they let you in on what happened. You were there, but somehow you missed what actually happened. That's because you were so caught up in the content of the conversation, your buddy explains. You cared so deeply about the product timelines that you were blind to the conditions. You know, how people were feeling and acting, what tone they were taking, stuff like that. You saw all that while still carrying on a heated conversation, you ask? Yeah, your coworker explains. I always watch 2 elements. When things start turning ugly, I watch the content of the conversation, the topic under discussion, along with the conditions, what people are doing in response. I look for and examine both what and why. If you can see why people are becoming upset or holding back their views or even going silent, you can do something to get back on track. You look at the conditions, and then you know what to do to get back on track? Sometimes, your friend answers, but you've got to learn exactly what to look for. It's a form of social first aid. By watching for the moment a conversation starts turning unhealthy, you can respond quickly.
The sooner you notice you're not in dialogue, the easier it is to get back and the lower the costs. But, your friend continues, the sad corollary is that the longer it takes to notice you're not in dialogue, the harder it is to get back and the higher the costs. You can't believe how obvious this advice is, and yet you've never thought of such a thing. Weirder still, your friend has. In fact, he has a whole vocabulary for what's going on during a crucial conversation. It's as if you've been speaking another language. Watch for conditions. In truth, most of us do have trouble dual processing, simultaneously watching for content and conditions, especially when both stakes and emotions are high. We get so caught up in what we're saying that it can be nearly impossible to pull ourselves out of the argument in order to see what's happening to ourselves and to others. Even when we are startled by what's going on, enough so that we think, yipes, this has turned ugly, now what? We may not know what to look for in order to turn things around. We may not see enough of what's happening. How could that be? How could we be smack dab in the middle of a heated debate and not really seeing what's going on? A metaphor might help. It's akin to fly fishing for the first time with an experienced angler. Your buddy keeps telling you to cast your fly 6 feet upstream from that brown trout just out there. Only you can't see a brown trout just out there. He can. That's because he knows what to look for. You think you do. You think you need to look for a brown trout. In reality, you need to look for the distorted image of a brown trout that's underwater while the sun is reflecting in your eyes. You have to look for elements other than the thing that your dad has stuffed and mounted over the fireplace. It takes both knowledge and practice to know what to look for and then actually see it. So what do you look for when caught in the middle of a crucial conversation? What do you need to see in order to catch problems before they become too severe? Actually, it helps to watch for three different conditions. The moment a conversation turns crucial, signs that people don't feel safe, silence or violence, and your own style under stress. Let's consider each of these conversation killers in turn. Learn to spot crucial conversations. First, stay alert for the moment a conversation turns from a routine or harmless discussion into a crucial one. In a similar vein, as you anticipate entering a tough conversation, pay heed to the fact that you're about to enter the danger zone. Otherwise, you can easily get sucked into silly games before you realize what's happened. And as we suggested earlier, the further you stray off track, the harder it can be to return and the higher the costs. To help catch problems early, reprogram your mind to pay attention to the signs that suggest you're in a crucial conversation. Some people first notice physical signals. Their stomach gets tight or their eyes get dry. Think about what happens to your body when conversations get tough. Everyone is a little bit different. What are your cues? Whatever they are, learn to look at them as signs to step back, slow down, and start with heart before things get out of hand. Others notice their emotions before they notice signs in their body. They realize they are scared, hurt, or angry, and are beginning to react to or suppress these feelings. These emotions can also be great cues to tell you to step back, slow down, and take steps to turn your brain back on. Some people's first cue is behavioral. For them, it's like an out-of-body experience. They see themselves raising their voice, pointing their finger like a loaded weapon, or becoming very quiet. It's only then that they realize how they're feeling. So take a moment to think about some of your toughest conversations. What cues can you use to recognize that your brain is beginning to disengage and you're at risk of moving away from healthy dialogue? Learn to look for safety problems. If you can catch signs that the conversation is starting to turn crucial before you get sucked so far into the actual argument that you can never withdraw from the content, then you can start dual processing immediately. And what exactly should you watch for? People who are gifted at dialogue keep a constant vigil on safety. They pay attention to the content, that's a given, and they watch for signs that people are becoming fearful. When friends, loved ones, or colleagues move away from healthy dialogue, freely adding to the pool of meaning, Either forcing their opinions into the pool or purposefully keeping their ideas out of the pool, they immediately turn their attention to whether or not others feel safe. When it's safe, you can say anything. Here's why gifted communicators keep a close eye on safety. Dialogue calls for the free flow of meaning, period. And nothing kills the flow of meaning like fear. When you fear that people aren't buying into your ideas, you start pushing too hard. When you fear that you may be harmed in some way, you start withdrawing and hiding. Both these reactions, to fight and to take flight, are motivated by the same emotion, fear. On the other hand, if you make it safe enough, you can talk about almost anything and people will listen. If you don't fear that you're being attacked or humiliated, you yourself can hear almost anything and not become defensive. This is a pretty remarkable claim. Think about it. We're suggesting that people rarely become defensive simply because of what you're saying. They only become defensive when they no longer feel safe. The problem is not the content of your message, but the condition of the conversation. As we saw earlier, from the time we are quite small, we begin to conclude that you can't be both honest and respectful simultaneously. In essence, we conclude that there are some messages you just can't give to some people. And over time, that list of messages gets longer and longer until we find ourselves handling most crucial conversations badly. If what we're suggesting here is true, then the problem is not the message. The problem is that you and I fail to help others feel safe hearing the message. If you can learn to see when people start to feel unsafe, you can take action to fix it. That means the first challenge is to simply see and understand that safety is at risk. Think about your own experience. Can you remember receiving really blistering feedback from someone at some point in your life, but in this instance, you didn't become defensive? Instead, you absorbed the feedback. You reflected on it. You allowed it to influence you. If so, ask yourself, why? Why in this instance were you able to absorb potentially threatening feedback so well? If you're like the rest of us, it's because you believed that the other person had your best interest in mind. In addition, you respected the other person's opinion. You felt safe receiving the feedback because you trusted the motives and ability of the other person. You didn't need to defend yourself from what was being said, even if you didn't like what they were saying. On the other hand, if you don't feel safe, you can't take any feedback. It's as if the pool of meaning has a lid on it. What do you mean I look good? Is that some kind of joke? Are you insulting me? When you don't feel safe, even well-intended comments are suspect. When it's unsafe, you start to go blind. By carefully watching for safety violations, not only can you see when dialogue is in danger, but you can also re-engage your brain. As we've said before, when your emotions start cranking up, key brain functions start shutting down. Not only do you prepare to take flight, but your peripheral vision actually narrows. In fact, when you feel genuinely threatened, you can scarcely see beyond what's right in front of you. By pulling yourself out of the content of an argument and looking for signs that safety is at risk, you re-engage your brain and your full vision returns. As we suggested earlier, when you give your brain a new problem to consider, for example, keep alert for signs that safety is at risk, it affects your brain functioning. Your higher reasoning centers stay more active, and you're far less likely to be dumbed down and far more likely to succeed in your crucial conversation. Don't let safety problems lead you astray. Let's add a note of caution. When others begin to feel unsafe, they start acting in annoying ways. Now, since they're feeling unsafe, you should be thinking to yourself, hey, they're feeling unsafe. I need to do something, maybe make it safer. That's what you should be thinking. Unfortunately, since others feel unsafe, they may be trying to make fun of you, insult you, or bowl you over with their arguments. This kind of aggressive behavior doesn't exactly bring out the diplomat in you. So instead of taking their attack as a sign that safety is at risk, you take it at its face
as an attack. I'm under attack, you think. Then the dumb part of your brain kicks in and you respond in kind. Or maybe you try to escape. Either way, you're not dual processing and then pulling out a skill to restore safety. Instead, you're becoming part of the problem as you get pulled into the fight. Imagine the magnitude of what we're suggesting here. We're asking you to recode silence and violence as signs that people are feeling unsafe. We're asking you to fight your natural tendency to respond in kind. We're asking you to undo years of practice, maybe even eons of genetic shaping that prod you to take flight or pick a fight when under attack, and recode the stimulus. Ah, that's a sign that the other person feels unsafe. And then what? Do something to make it safe. Obviously, this can be a difficult undertaking, but it's worth it. This skill is the pivot point for everything that follows. It is also the gateway to gaining all the benefits that come to those who are skilled at crucial conversations. Imagine increased influence, enhanced relationships, stronger teams, and more effective leadership. Turn on your capacity to recognize and respond to safety problems. In the next chapter, we'll explore how. For now, simply learn to look for safety and then be curious, not angry or frightened. Silence and violence. As people begin to feel unsafe, they start down one of two unhealthy paths. They move either to silence, withholding meaning from the pool, or to violence, trying to force meaning into the pool. That part we know. But let's add a little more detail. Just as a little knowledge of what to look for can turn blurry water into a brown trout, knowing a few of the common forms of silence and violence helps you see safety problems when they first start to happen. That way you can step out, restore safety, and return to dialogue before the damage is too great. Silence. Silence consists of any act to purposefully withhold information from the pool of meaning. It's almost always done as a means of avoiding potential problems, and it always restricts the flow of meaning. Methods range from playing verbal games to avoiding a person entirely. The three most common forms of silence are masking, avoiding, and withdrawing. Masking. Masking consists of understating or selectively showing our true opinions. Sarcasm, sugarcoating, and couching are some of the more popular forms. For example, I think your idea is brilliant. Yeah, that's it. I just worry that others won't catch these subtle nuances. Some ideas come before their time, so expect some minor resistance. Real meaning? Your idea is insane, and people will fight it with their last breath. Or this example. Oh yeah, that'll work like a charm. Offer people a discount, and they'll drive all the way across town just to save 6 cents on a box of soap. Where do you come up with this stuff? Real meaning? What a dumb idea. Avoiding. Avoiding involves steering completely away from sensitive subjects. We talk, but without addressing the real issues. For example, how does your new suit look? Well, you know, that blue's my favorite color. Real meaning? What happened? Did you buy your clothes at the circus? Or, speaking of ideas for cost cutting, what if we diluted the coffee or used both sides of our copier paper? Real meaning? If I offer trivial suggestions, perhaps we can avoid discussing sensitive things like staff inefficiency. Withdrawing. Withdrawing means pulling out of a conversation altogether. We either exit the conversation or exit the room. For example, excuse me, I've got to take this call. Real meaning? I'd rather gnaw off my arm than spend one more minute in this useless meeting. Or, sorry, I'm not going to talk about how to split up the phone bill again. I'm not sure our friendship can stand another battle. Exit. Real meaning? We can't talk about even the simplest of topics without arguing. Violence. Violence consists of any verbal strategy that attempts to convince, control, or compel others to your point of view. It violates safety by trying to force meaning into the pool. Methods range from name-calling and monologuing to making threats. The three most common forms are controlling, labeling, and attacking. Controlling.
Controlling consists of coercing others to your way of thinking. It's done through either forcing your views on others or dominating the conversation. Methods include cutting others off, overstating your facts, speaking in absolutes, changing subjects, or using directive questions to control the conversation. For example, there's not a person in the world who hasn't bought one of these things. They're the perfect gift. Real meaning? I can't justify spending our hard-earned savings on this expensive toy, but I really want it. Or this example. We tried their product, but it was an absolute disaster. Everyone knows that they can't deliver on time and that they offer the worst customer service on the planet. Real meaning? I'm not certain of the real facts, so I'll use hyperbole to get your attention. Labeling. Labeling is putting a label on people or ideas so we can dismiss them under a general stereotype or category. For example, your ideas are practically Neanderthal. Any thinking person would follow my plan. Real meaning? I can't argue my case on its merits, so to get what I want, I'll attack you personally. Or this example. You're not going to listen to them, are you? For crying out loud. First, they're from headquarters. Second, they're engineers. Need I say more? Real meaning? If I pretend that all people from headquarters and all engineers are somehow bad and wrong, I won't have to explain anything. Attacking. Attacking speaks for itself. You've moved from winning the argument to making the person suffer. Tactics include belittling and threatening. For example, try that stupid little stunt and see what happens. Real meaning? I will get my way on this even if I have to badmouth you and threaten some vague punishment. Or, don't listen to a word Jim is saying. I'm sorry, Jim, but I'm on to you. You're just trying to make it better for your team while making the rest of us suffer. I've seen you do it before. You're a real jerk. You know that? I'm sorry, but someone has to have the guts to tell it like it is. Real meaning. To get my way, I'll say bad things about you and then pretend that I'm the only one with any integrity. Look for your style under stress. Let's say you've been watching for both content and conditions. You're paying special attention to when a conversation turns crucial. To catch this important moment, you're looking for signs that safety is at risk. As safety is violated, you even know to watch for various forms of silence and violence. So are you now fully armed? Have you seen all there is to see? Actually, no. Perhaps the most difficult element to watch closely as you're madly dual processing is your own behavior. Frankly, most people have trouble pulling themselves away from the tractor beam of the argument at hand. Then you've got the problem other people present as they employ all kinds of tactics. You've got to watch them like a hawk. It's little wonder that paying close attention to your own behavior tends to take a back seat. Besides, it's not like you can actually step out of your body and observe yourself. You're on the wrong side of your eyeballs. Low self-monitors. The truth is, we all have trouble monitoring our own behavior at times. We usually lose any semblance of social sensitivity when we become so consumed with ideas and causes that we lose track of what we're doing. We try to bully our way through. We speak when we shouldn't. We withdraw into a punishing silence. We do things that don't work, all in the name of a cause. We eventually become so unaware that we become a bit like this fellow of Jack Handy's invention. People were always talking about how mean this guy was who lived on our block. But I decided to go see for myself. I went to his door, but he said he wasn't the mean guy. The mean guy lived in that house over there. No, you stupid idiot, I said. That's my house. Unfortunately, when you fail to monitor your own behavior, you can look pretty silly. For example, you're talking to your spouse about the fact that he or she left you sitting at the auto repair shop for over an hour. After pointing out that it was a simple misunderstanding, your spouse exclaims, "You don't have to get angry." Then you utter those famous words, "I'm not angry." Of course, you're spraying spit as you shout out your denial, and the vein on your forehead is swelled to the size of a teenage python. You quite naturally don't see the inconsistency in your response. You're in the middle of the whole thing, and you don't appreciate it one bit when your spouse laughs at you. You also play this denial game when you ingeniously answer the question, "What's wrong?" "Nothing's wrong," you whimper. Then you shuffle your feet, stare at the floor, and look wounded. Become a vigilant self-monitor. What does it take to be able to step out of an argument and watch for process, including what you yourself are doing and the impact you're having?
you have to become a vigilant self-monitor. That is, pay close attention to what you're doing and the impact it's having, and then alter your strategy if necessary. Specifically, watch to see if you're having a good or bad impact on safety. Your style